So it is my great pleasure to welcome to Many Rivers Books and Tea for the first time, Jihong Padma. She is the author of this lovely book. Stuart and I had the distinct pleasure of interviewing her on our radio show last Saturday, Mystical Positivist. The book is called Living the Season, Zen Practice for Transformative Times. It was a lovely conversation, and Jihong has been studying Zen with the Korean Chogye Zen tradition for over 20 years, I believe, and has been a teacher in that tradition. She leads retreats at places like Esalen and Omega Institute in New York, and has quite a resume of accomplishments, but tonight we will be hearing about living the season, I think, among other things. I am delighted to welcome her here to Many Rivers. Please join me in welcoming her.
So, I began thinking about Many Rivers in August, right after teaching at Omega all summer. It was just at that time when the book was ready to arrive in the world, and the publisher asked me to arrange a book tour. And this very place on Earth, I said, this is one of my favorite places. I have to find a way to get here. So I've been waiting to meet you all for like 5 months. You can't imagine how excited I am. You know, it's sort of like we're already old friends. So I'll just share some things from the book to get us started. And then what I really love is when people have questions. That was why the Mystical Positive was so much fun. It's like I expected to be reading from the book, but actually Rob and Stuart had the most fascinating questions, and the time just went by. So I am sure that you all have some sort of great question, you know, something that brought you here. We all have a great question that moves us. You know, whether it's where did the sun, moon, and stars come from, or, you know, what is love and how do I actualize that? You know, or before I was born, where did I come from? You know, where when I die, where do I go? Or what does real service look like? You know, we all of our questions take different forms, but I think they really come back to one question, which is, what am I? You know, so when we come to that point, when we keep that great question, then everything in our world becomes our sacred space, and the heart itself becomes our temple. So that's the place I'm kind of inviting us into. But meanwhile, we have the skillful means of the book. So this came out of many years of teaching. I've been teaching as a chaplain at Wellesley College, serving our Buddhist community there since like 1994, and sending out weekly teaching messages to my community, and certainly done other Dharma talks in many other places. And so this is the kind of compilation. And I sort of look at it all, and one thing that's really important is that for me, the Dharma is really reflected in the natural world. This is, I think, very characteristic of Korean Zen, and Sung Sansun, my teacher, would always say, if you have a question, then go ask the mountain. You know, and the mountains will have a good answer. And I've tried that a few times, and it was actually very helpful. So today, before coming out to visit you, I actually went to Duncan's Landing, and, you know, I corresponded there with the rocks and the ocean. So in the book, I've arranged it by means of the four seasons. And just to make that, what the connection is, really clear, it is my sense that when we come to be truly ourselves, then we're naturally aligned with the world around us. If you think even back to the beginning of Buddhism, you know, Buddha, when he was there under the Bodhi tree, was tempted in all kinds of ways, you know, by those forces of unskillfulness which are within. And finally, you know, the most challenging moments You know, Mara is there before him with all of his armies, you know, representing those energies of unskillfulness. And he's like, well, who do you think you are to get enlightenment anyway? You know, that seat doesn't belong to you, it belongs to me. You know, so at that time, Buddha doesn't have armies. He doesn't have anyone to speak for him, but what he does is he touches the earth. And then the earth herself rises up as a goddess and attests to the innumerable lifetimes he's spent attaining the way. So that's the Dharma that resonates with me. It's very grounded. And when I work with people, I think part of the beauty is helping them to really come home to the body and come home to that world around them, you know, their place in the family of all beings. So the book starts out with winter. Now, you know, I'm just from Boston, you know, so our seasons are very distinct. You know, if I was living here in California, maybe the book would have like a more, you know, even tempo. But we have a very distinct winter. And so in winter, right, my friends are all buried under several feet of snow. What we really need to do is we need to find that light in the darkness. You know, we need to find that place that nourishes ourselves. And we need to have that kind of try mind, you know, hope, courage, trust. And that's a place that I've walked many generations of students through. And, you know, through winter, then we come into spring, you know, right? It's like that seed, you know, has come into the light. And then what happens naturally is that we're making connections, you know, like the tendrils of pea plants, you know, or the way that the forest, the roots of the trees in a forest connect with each other and correspond with each other. So that now when we see a forest, we recognize it's not separate trees, but it's a whole living ecosystem. So in that way, too, we find our place in Indra's net, the place of interconnection, interdependence. And then moving through spring, we find ourselves in that place of full blossoming, you know, where we express what it is that we are here to express, just as the acorn goes inevitably into an oak tree. You know, there is some dharma which is within us. Subhangsanim, who was one of my teachers, would say, you know, if you're clever, you can fool me. If you're very, very clever, maybe you can fool Sansanim. But you can't fool your true self. You know, so just in that way, we all have our own destiny, our own calling. And as we practice our spiritual practice, we become more truly who it is that we're here to be. And that's a gift to the world. And having, you know, given into that place of blossoming, everything then has the autumn cycle. And I think that's important, too, because in our culture, we're encouraged to be all the time 110% on. And nobody actually can do that. It's not natural. So in the autumn, we have a sense of appreciation and gratitude and a sense of releasing. So if we look through our lives at our relationships, our families, we can see these cycles. We can trace them. And then it becomes easier to move with grace and ease through the timeless here and now. So, the actual book. Right now, we've been in this time of great transformation. Kairos, a turning moment. To the Greeks, Kairos referred to the sacred and vital nature of time, a choice point in which we must seize the opportunity as it arises. We're faced with Kairos now, right? The gifts as well as necessity of being able to turn around some of the desecration of our sacred earth. You know, we have the potential to shift from a culture of competition and marketing-driven hunger to a culture of sustainability and cooperation. The earth requires our awakening and compassionate action for a future to be possible. Fortunately, Zen practice provides a grounding and centering energy through which we can approach these times of great change. As we practice, we find ourselves, coming home to the body. Mind and body become one. Inside and outside become one. We and our life completely become one. So when we give ourselves to our life 100%, we have that experience of this unified whole, and then being able to see the world around us with eyes of wholeness. You know, seeing how connected we are to everything, then we naturally refrain from causing harm, because that would be hurting ourselves. And we begin to see that as a natural expression of ourselves, just coming into relation. That's really needed right now. You know, it's within our society, our collective acquisition of knowledge currently outreaches our expression of wisdom. As Albert Einstein once said, the release of atom power has changed everything except our way of thinking. The solution to this problem lies in the heart of mankind. So the technological advances of this century have given us greater mastery of the physical world without requisite co-development of the heart. So thus, as a species, we have some resistance to our own unfolding at this time. In order to take the next steps together, we need to reawaken our inner compass by connecting with that hidden wholeness, our awakened heart-mind, and take action that reconnects whole communities. In order to live well, it's necessary to come into alignment with family, community, the natural world, discerning and honoring all our relations. We then find ourselves within a sacred and undivided circle. So as we do that, then the natural world presses us to come more fully into our own experience. You know, we begin to see how those elements inside our body, you know, the earth, water, air, and fire of life reflect the sacred earth. The wholeness of body rhythms reflects the interconnectedness of natural rhythms. The dynamic change we witness as tides rise and fall. And receiving teaching from tides and this great earth, we find our inner wholeness, the mandala that is our life. And this unbroken circle encompasses the full spectrum of moment-to-moment experience. In order to feel and be present to joy, we also need to feel and be present to pain. You know, sometimes when doing ceremony for people, the healing gift is to be able to cry with them without turning away. Just letting that be the path of the Bodhisattva. One breath, one undivided circle. So, since this book is, you know, it's Korean Zen. You know, if I was writing from another lineage, I might have like a lengthy discourse about this and that. And so that's one thing I'll say, is that our Korean Zen lineage is really earthy. Sun Tzu Nim would always say, 5 minutes of experience is better than 10,000 words. So we're actually going to do something. So if you just want to find yourself, you know, at home in your body, feel that rhythm as the breath as it's moving through you now. Whether you're noting it in the lungs or the lower belly, wherever it is you most clearly can feel and sense the breath. you'd like, as you're watching the breath, you can count the breath up to 10 and then begin again. Noting any warmth or any coolness within the breath. Any sensation at all. So now we're going to continue that awareness and do a simple exercise. Taking a minute just to feel, first of all, feeling our feet on the ground. I'm going to stand for this one, obviously. But you guys can sit if you like. And through our feet, feeling our connection to the earth. Then, for all of us, we can just bring our arms up above our head, taking a gentle stretch. We breathe in, breathing out, bring them down, making a big circle. Right, so breathing in. Breathing out. Breathing in. Breathing out. So just continue this now at your own pace. And just finishing the one that we're on. And so then through this, we come more fully into our awareness of the body. Feeling that energy within us drops our awareness from the mind and the heart really to the gut, what in Korean Zen is called the tanjan, or the energy garden. As a society, we have a lot of energy up here, and believe me, I've spent most of my life working in academia, lots of energy here. Sometimes I've done this exercise with college students, and they've said to me, you know, this is the first time in months I felt like I was in my body. So I'm like, all right, you know, good to know. You might want to spend some more time there. And so, or as a society, we might be emotional. We might have our energy here in the heart. And so this is just a way of bringing things into balance again. You know, so that we can live a good life. Then as we do that, you know, we have this place of clarity and energy. What happens next? You know, we need to find a way to use this in moment-to-moment life. How does it function? So, In Buddhism, sometimes we describe the interconnectedness of things through a net. Imagining this net, right, the horizontal threads representing time, vertical threads representing space. So where each of these threads is meeting the other, there's a crystal. And each crystal is reflecting not only every other crystal, but every reflection of every other crystal. So just in that way, we're always coming into being together. We're composed of these reflections of each other. What's really neat is that we can go the other side into the neuropsychology of things, and actually they have found these mirror neurons in the brain, the mirror neurons tell us what the state of the body is. You know, they're receiving those signals all the way through the limbic system, through the body, through the limbic system, you know, to the prefrontal cortex through the mirror neurons. What's funny about that is that they've discovered those mirror neurons that tell us how our body is are the exact same mirror neurons that tell us what another person is feeling when we're talking to them. You know, so our ability to be in connection with others is very much based on our ability to be in connection with ourselves. So in our Buddhist world, when we talk about interdependence, that's just primary. You know, all the time, Samsonin would say, you know, we describe this I, this is me, this is myself. But, you know, what is that I? You know, what is it, my fingernail, right? Is it my business card? You know, where did that I come from? You know, where does that I go? You know, so all the time we say this is me, this is I, it's almost crazy. The more that we practice, the more naturally we see ourselves coming into being moment by moment, you know, as a kind of dynamic and relational process. But how do you really attain that? It's all a good idea, and most of what I'm teaching is extraordinarily simple. Like, some of my greatest teachers have been the most simple in their approach. Like, easy to understand, but how do we attain that? So the world is always bringing us a good teacher. Here, I'll tell you how the understanding came home to me on one ordinary day. On that particular day, I had a clear sense of making connections, which was entirely about logistics, driven by a tight schedule. Waking at 5:05 a.m., practicing meditation until 6:25 a.m., leaving the house to catch the 7 a.m. bus from Kendall Square, Cambridge, to Wellesley College. Arriving at 8 a.m. at Wellesley, making Xeroxes and delivering them for a noon event, making Xeroxes for my stress reduction class, catching the 9 a.m. bus, and arriving at Kendall Square at 10 a.m., right on schedule. Now, I was right where I needed to be, to catch the subway downtown for a stress reduction class I teach at lunchtime in the financial district. So this is where the universe provides a new lesson. As I get out of the subway train, I momentarily look down, adjusting the two bags I'm carrying and the box of Xeroxes, rebalancing. In that moment, I hear something, a brief chorus of sound. As I look up, I see someone has fallen backward on the escalator. The man is in fact still falling head first. His head bumps each steel step. So with each lurch downward, my stomach jumps. This moment seems expanded, as if time has stopped. His falling down the up escalator seems to defy laws of gravity. at that moment, for a moment, I pause. There's a man farther up the escalator, near the falling man's outstretched legs, who's stopping his fall by grabbing his leg. To my side, there's a bevy of passersby who have decided it's a good day to take the elevator, the door of which is closing. In that moment, the illusion of a neatly constructed agenda hovers and disappears. This is the connection I need to make, right, however awkward it might seem. Even as I run up the escalator, you know, a part of my mind still cries out, what can you do? You know, you're not built brawnily enough to haul this man to a seat. Yet, as I get there, the second man on the escalator is struggling to pull him to his feet, or at least away from the teeth of the escalator. I lean and push from behind. As the man's form caves backward, I see a place to give a focused push, the kind learned in volleyball. The second man catches his body, anchors it forward, and the man finds his feet. Just at that moment, we arrive at the top of the escalator. I check in with him. Are you okay? He replies that he is. A woman says, you hit your head. He replies, that's okay. I don't keep much in it. Right. So he was no doubt ready for a chiropractic appointment the next day, but no other injury occurred. You know, so someone later that day expressed surprise that I had not stopped to consider the bags I left at the bottom of the escalator. Right, I knew for me the bags weren't in the way of a spontaneous response. The meditation practice helps me step out of my own way to see the connection and to respond. Every now and then I do get a wake-up call. And although the experiences initially are gut-wrenching, at the end I feel more alive, more authentic, more myself. So did I help him or did I help myself? Right, is there a difference? So, you know, within this book, you know, there's many stories I tell. One of the stories that's not in the book, I'll tell anyway, is the story of going to Cambodia with my teacher Maha Gosananda. So Maha Gosananda was, I guess, what I would consider a living saint, someone whose energy field filled the room, like the light of 1,000 candles. And at the same time, he was very, very modest. And he was spontaneous. He would just show up at the door of the Zen Center, you know, sort of wrapped in layers and layers of saffron. We would open the door and show him upstairs and give him tea, and he would give us whatever was in his pocket. Maybe it was a copy of the Metta Sutra or, you know, some other gift that someone had given to him en route. He was someone who really knew how to travel lightly. And so on this particular week, I was doing a solo retreat. In our Korean Zen, we would sit solo retreats because it's a really good way of getting intimate with yourself. So I was in a cabin in the country, and someone came to the door, one of our community people, saying, you know, Maha Gosananda's in Cambridge, and he's asking for you. So I thought, okay, you know, my practice is in the city after all. So I went into the Zen Center, and the next morning after meditation practice, we were sitting in the kitchen having breakfast, and he told me about his peace walk to Cambodia coming up. So Maha Gosananda was nominated for the Nobel Peace Prize 9 times for his work to bring peace to his country. I think they only figured that because the Dalai Lama and Thich Nhat Hanh had already gotten Nobel Peace Prizes, they needed to, you know, change it up a little bit and not have another Buddhist monk. But he had done these walks through whatever part of Cambodia was the most in conflict. Mahagosananda had only escaped the genocide himself because he was in India and Thailand. He and the other Cambodian monks who were training would cry every night. But as soon as the war was over, he went among the refugees in the camps and would chant from the Dhammapada, you know, hatred is never overcome by hatred, but by love alone is healed. So he, on the first Dhammayatra, took a walk with his students from the refugee camps at the border of Thailand right into Phnom Penh. Fighting was still going on between the Khmer Rouge and the government, and the animosities were such that these families that had ended up on different sides of the line when the war was going on had been separated now for many years. And so this first walk was a great reunion and reconciliation. But war continued, and so he would take the Dhammayatra right through the battlefields. When the battles were not going on, he took the walk through the areas where the landmines had been placed, you know, through the narrow path that had been cleared to bring awareness to the huge issue that Cambodia had. Right, years later, you know, the war's over, but all of these landmines still in the ground. And on this occasion, he was doing a second Dhammayatra of the year because Cambodia was preparing for its first independent elections. A year before, the coalition government had dissolved and there had been tanks in the street. So let's just say people weren't really sure how this was going to work out. He told me about this Dhammayatra, and he put down actually some French, you know, some francs. You know, he pulled that out of his pocket. He was sort of like, you know, please come. That time I was the abbot of the Cambridge Zen Center, so about 45 residents, you know, three buildings, offering programs to our community, which totaled probably about 30 hours a week. Not an easy thing to just take off on the plane for South Asia, but I thought if I can pull this together in that 2 weeks we have, then I'll go. And actually, amazingly, auspiciously, things did come together. I did find a ticket. My staff was very, very supportive. At that time, the State Department advisory said, don't go to Cambodia. Like, don't. And then if you do go, don't go outside of Phnom Penh, the capital. If you do go outside of Phnom Penh, don't travel in a convoy of less than three vehicles. So this was all completely like not what we were doing. We were going to be outside sleeping in hammocks in the country as we walked across the countryside. You know, I'd never gone camping before. And so at that time, actually, I had one of these conversations one does with a parent. You know, I said, I'm going to go to Hong Kong. You know, Hong Kong was part of the ticket. And she said, where else? And I said, well, Southeast Asia. I'm not exactly sure on the details. And she called me back. She said, I was just talking to your father, and he said that Southeast Asia is a real euphemism for Vietnam. She said, you're not going to Vietnam, are you? I said, no, I'm not going to Vietnam. She said, you promise? I said, yeah. So, you know, I had my own kind of concerns about this, and especially given the mosquitoes in Cambodia, I've used the jungle as their own experimental ground for the new forms of malaria. But I felt like if anything happened, if I was with Mahagosananda, I would have a very auspicious rebirth. And so, you know, we went, and we would wake at something like 3:30 in the morning to avoid the midday heat. And so we would set off in this complete darkness. I was walking with these Cambodian nuns. They were all dressed in white. I was dressed in gray, because our gray is our Korean Zen tradition. And we didn't have language to communicate, but there was still a lot of communication going on, a very close connection. They were grandmothers, most of them. And they were walking these roads in extreme heat, many miles every day, just wearing flip-flops, and their courage and their tenacity really inspired me. Whenever we stopped at a temple, we were offered, you know, all of the blessings of the monks, you know, their sangha, beautiful food. It was almost overwhelming. And at some point during that walk, there was a monk. Mahagosananda partnered with the Nippanzai Mahoji order of Japanese Buddhism because they had a tradition of doing pilgrimages for peace as well. It was a good fit. So Murakami Sensei, who was one of the Japanese monks, got a bit sick during the walk. And so at the last minute, Mahagosananda invited me to give a Dharma talk with him. You have to imagine, this is not like a being in the room with you lovely people. This Dharma talk was being broadcast to the entire village through loudspeakers. And it was also very, very unconventional because in these Theravadan countries, the sense of hierarchy is very clear. The nuns in Theravadan countries do not have full ordination, and so they're not on the same basis as the monks. Also, age is considered to be an important factor. So there I was, you know, this like 20, maybe 28 years old American nun, and they didn't know quite what to make of that. And also, I'm not that extroverted, and I'm not a Theravadan Buddhist. I've never been to Cambodia. I would have liked to get a little bit better situated. But so what I did then was I began with the Metta Sutra. The Metta Sutra is something that Mahagosananda really, you know, he took that to a place that is just beyond words. So in honor of his teaching, I began with the Metta Sutra. If you can imagine, Mahagosananda was serving as my translator. Sort of like having the Dalai Lama be your translator, it feels awkward. But there it was. And so I began, you know, just as a mother, at the risk of her own life, would watch over and protect her only child. So at that time, Mahagosananda did a translation. And I noticed his translation was longer than when I spoke, but, you know, okay, so it is. And right then I continued after he finished that. You know, so shall one with a boundless heart cherish all living beings. And then pause, you know, and he'd translate. Above, below, and across, without any hatred, without any enmity, without any obstruction. Whether one is sitting, standing, walking, or lying down, one should maintain this awareness. This, they say, is to attain the blessed state in this very life. So I found out afterwards that when I began with the first line of the Metta Sutra, Mahagosananda actually translated the entire Metta Sutra. When I did the next line, he did a commentary on the Metta Sutra. When I continued, he did a commentary on the commentary. And so I can't even imagine what a great Dharma talk that must have been. I wish I could have heard it. You know, all the time he never told him that I was quoting the Buddha. At the end of this, he taught them a few phrases in English. Only don't know. You know, go straight and no problem. So what are those? Those are my Korean Zen master, Zen Master Sung San's Korean English way of expressing teaching in a sort of very pithy phrases. So only don't know. When we have that mind that's before any idea, then it's open to everything. Everything is clear in front of us. Go straight means when you're doing something, completely do it. Then everything is no problem. So if you've got that, then you've got that very rare Khmer Korean lineage. Yeah. The Metta Sutra. So, right, just as a mother at the risk of her own life would watch over and protect her only child. So just in that way should one cherish all living beings. you know, above, below, and across, without any hatred, without any obstruction, without any enmity. Whether one is sitting, standing, walking, or lying down, one should maintain that awareness. So, you know, this is to attain nirvana in this very life. So the idea of nirvana not being some sort of stillness and bliss that you find at the end of the rainbow, you know, but really finding it here and now if you're going to find it anywhere. Like, as Thich Nhat Hanh, actually, he painted a calligraphy for my community, and it says, "The kingdom is now or never." Sure. So, in Zen training, we use these questions to push past the edge of our knowing to that place before questions, our original mind. These great questions are found within all world cultures. They arise from the great mystery. Within Zen, we return the immense gift of these questions with another question. So when I walk into a room to give teaching, that great question is my true reference point. That space of not knowing is the only place from which Zen teaching can really arise. So I, like tonight, I have maybe some idea, some outline, but then I just let things unfold. And so one time I taught at a bookstore in Tehachapi, sort of Central Valley, and these two kids came in, and I was speaking that time about our human condition. Trees understand their authentic path, their job, and they manifest it wholeheartedly. Birds fly, fish swim, all animals understand their job. But we human beings have a bit more work to do. We have a big job. So one of the boys asked, "Why do human beings have this big job?" So I said to him, "Why are we here? Why are we alive?" He said, "Why are we alive? Right? Why are we alive? I don't know." So he really didn't know. He just had a big question that was asking itself. So then he asked, "Do you ever get the answer to your big question?" Along with a few other wonderful, huge, wide-open questions like that. So these questions are a huge gift in breaking open our preconceived ideas of the world. In our Zen training, asking questions is an expression of love. It's a way of seeing the luminous nature within each other and drawing it forward. So on another day, I gave interviews at the Zen Center. A young man I'd worked with came in. He spent a couple years in the Peace Corps since I had last seen him. And he said, "How can I help all beings? And what is my true self?" I said, "Those aren't different questions, they're the same question. When we ask how we may be of service, at that moment our true self is revealed." Although it can't be put into words, that direction is a good hint. So, you know, really my hope is that people find their own way of accessing that great question. This book is providing a compass. You know, it's based in my own experience and the teaching I've drawn from life and from coming into relationship. But what I feel like it does and how it serves for people who aren't practicing Zen is it gives you a way to source from that. It's like you're not practicing at a Zen center, probably, but it's like you are kind of spiritual seekers and maybe culturally creative. And so this is serving as a gate through which you can experience some of that clarity that the tradition gives you. When I teach at Omega and Esalen, you know, and at colleges, it's like what I'm mostly working with are people who don't have formal training, but they are curious. You know, they do want to live consciously, and they want to find some guide, maybe a spiritual friend, you know, to walk with them through what life is presenting. So this book can serve in that way, you know, as a bit of a compass and a conversation to enter into and a spiritual friendship. So there's some good things about having the book. Just to say. So sometime I was teaching at Esalen a course on Zen and creativity. We began sitting in a meditation room with Sumi ink brushes, drawing on newsprint with water. You know, so if you can imagine drawing with water on newsprint, you know, in moments the lines you draw disappear. So we're intentionally choosing the newsprint and water because there's nothing to attach to. So just in that same way, really, the lines of our own lives are written in water. That impermanence is both our grief and our hope. True freedom, that is freedom to grow into our own radiant compassion, our own completeness, our own path with heart, which is then, like everything beautiful, like not only ours. So I feel like this is a powerful moment, right, in our society with all the change we're experiencing, to really just envision in our own way, in our heart, in our mind, in our life, action, what is our path with heart? Right, and then to begin as a gift to ourselves and to all beings, to embody it. And as we do that, our inner work then supports the healing of our society, the healing of the earth. That's a journey to wholeness rather than to perfection. That ideal state of perfection is never achieved. Every cell in our body, every facet of our being is always changing. Just as every leaf in the forest is changing through various hues of green, so we're always in the process of becoming. So we should be kind to ourselves and others, and keep in mind that every thought, every word, every action makes a difference. You know, by seeing wholeness in ourselves and others, we're strengthening the luminous threads of connection. You know, sometimes we can do it and sometimes we can't. That's okay. You know, as my teacher would say, keep try mind and a great question. Then you're on the path. It's the same as if you'd already arrived. Just continue 10,000 years nonstop, which means just give yourself completely. So on one occasion, a newspaper reporter said to my teacher, Mahagosananda, in your long and eventful life, you must have had many special moments. Yes, Mahagosananda replied. Which ones? Every moment, Mahagosananda answered. So my wish for you is that you live each moment fully, discovering within it the seeds of the awakened heart. Then the joy of creation holds you in its embrace. We meet the moment as a friend, and we discover that from the beginning we and the universe are never separate. So this is just a way of rediscovering that luminosity which we are. It's a welcoming home. So namaste. And if people have questions, I think that would be just lovely. Yeah?
Is the definition of karma?
Yeah. Of Dharma?
I read it somewhere. It's the law. Is that right?
That's one translation.
What could you add to that?
I would say Dharma is truth. So if you ask me what time it is, and I say it's 8:28, that's Dharma. That's truth, right? You know, in the traditional way, you know, it's the Dharma might be considered to be those teachings the Buddha gave during his life or the wider body of teaching. But in that kind of core way, right, Dharma is simply truth. so I would say it's a reminder for each of us to find what's true for us for now. But probably if you asked a scholar, especially a Hindu scholar, they would say it's the law. Yeah.
I just want to remark on the title of your book, Living the Season. So I just noticed for myself and so many others that when different seasons invite different things in, and like for instance, the fall is a time of harvest, but it's also a time of winding down, things dying and changing. And in the winter, we have less daylight, so I tend to be a little bit more introspective, not quite so out there.
Yeah.
Life is a little bit quieter. And then the spring is just like a burst of... Does your book kind of reflect that too?
It does.
Uh-huh.
It does. And actually, part of that got heightened for me by doing trips to Sonoma County in the winter. Right. At Wellesley, like most of our East Coast schools, we have January winter session, which meant that I would come out and give teaching in California that time. So during that, I remember going to a workshop someone was holding in Sebastopol and being struck by how outgoing everybody seemed. Like, it was just almost overwhelming. You know, like, how is that? You know, I had to sort of, like, gear up. You know, sort of felt like one of those cars that's just gone on, you know, like on from the ramp onto the highway and, you know, needs to accelerate quickly. And I was taken by that. I thought, well, that's just me. But then when I went back to Wellesley and I was at a meeting the next week, I noticed that everyone else was much more quiet, you know, sort of like almost that quiet of like a bear in the cave. And I was the extroverted one. I said, that's not usual. And it's like, there must, you know, I sort of checked in with myself and I realized that I had gotten, you know, probably about 1,000 times more sunlight than they had that previous month. And that's why I was more energized and they were more quiet. So I think it might have been a very different book if I was living in Southern California and the seasons weren't so distinct. But it is very much a teaching that I feel like I've received through, you know, through kinesthetic experience. Yeah.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Yeah.
I have a question about your working with young people and that sense of not being in their body. And do you think that's been exacerbated by technology? Or have you seen it just kind of a steady?
No, I do think that it's gotten stronger through technology, that people are spending more time connecting through, you know, the virtual world instead of like going out warm hand to warm hand. And, you know, obviously that's just how things are right now. It's the situation to work with. But for that reason, I feel incredibly grateful that I had a lot of good kinesthetic teaching in the beginning of my Zen. When I started practicing Zen, I was also practicing Aikido, a martial art. The nice thing about that is it gives you feedback. Like, if you space out, you get a hard fall on the mat. You know, you get what's called mat burn. And you remember that. You know, it's like, note to self, you know. You pay attention. That's very different from entering the gate through just having an idea in a book. So what I try to do with the people that I teach, and especially the student, is to find them some way to make this real and to keep it embodied. One thing that I did is really combining Zen sometimes with yoga through our spirituality programs. There are different expressions of that for different people. Like, not everyone is going to be a yogi, you know, but if you go and you do a walk and do that as a walking meditation, you know, then that's your Dharma practice. And we have all the time in our life. We need to walk someplace. So don't worry about finding time for meditation. You've already got it. You know, just work that mindful awareness into the walking. Feeling the feet lift, move, and place themselves on the ground, the muscles of the legs expanding and contracting. I'm sure it's been the case since the beginning of the tradition, that people have had to really find their way to trust their deep knowing through the body, but it feels like now it's more urgent than ever. And what happens when we disregard the body is we're also disregarding our connection to the earth, you know, because we come into the earth through our body. So, when I personally do a walk in nature every day, it's a primary part of my spiritual practice and a way of expressing gratitude. And because the gratitude is so primary, it just arises naturally out of meditation in my experience. You know, then I always find time for it. You know, even a short time, but that expression and that coming home to the body is so key. Yeah.
Did you find it a challenge to acquaint people who would come to your zendo, I guess you'd call it,
mm-hmm.
in Cambridge, to get them out of their heads?
Yeah, and I can say that goes, you know, like through the full spectrum. Whether they're young or whether they're older, you know, both with men and with women. There was some time, actually, which was really priceless. I was teaching a class for beginners in Cambridge, and we had someone in the class who was like 15 or 16 years old, but he was sort of some Dharma prodigy. He had already started practicing. He had a family that wasn't Buddhist at all. He was living on the North Shore of Massachusetts, which is not extremely experimental. And yet, right, he had already practiced with a Chinese Buddhist and with Thich Nhat Hanh. So when he came in, he was on the sutra side of things. He felt like he understood something. And I had to hit him hard. Sometimes in Korean Zen, we actually hit physically. Jim and I were having a conversation about how probably if Sun Sansnim was in the United States now, starting that, it would not always go over so well. But in this case, you know, I just hit him, you know, with words saying, that's only your understanding. You know, what's your experience? You know, what are you doing right now? And at that time, I hit him so hard, I thought he'd never come back. But now he and I have been Dharma friends for about 20 years. He's all grown up. So I have never met anyone that didn't have the capacity to practice, but we all have ways we need to get out of our own way. And that's where community is so helpful. The buddy system. So anyone else? Yeah?
You seem to love questions so much.
Yeah, I do.
Can I share some of my favorite question quotes?
Sure.
Falling in love with the question is daring to be its answer. Spirit is an ember, in eternity enduring, waiting to be fanned and fueled to flame. A question is the kindling, its asking is the fanning, its answer is the flame.
That's beautiful.
One more?
Yeah, go.
Okay. A question is a pebble gently dropped in the tide pool of a still and dreamless night. Thoughts take form on the ripples of eternity's dreamlessness and slowly come to life. Joined in thought to God, the ripples change to wings, and we become the dreamer, or?
That is lovely. Thank you. Yeah. Well, yeah.
A question I'm not sure how to phrase it. In the beginning of your talk, you spoke about the Buddha, and then with the Valrepa that came in.
Amara.
Palmera.
Yeah, Mara. Mara is just that force of unskillfulness. So, yeah.
So, that, could that be like self-doubt or self-sabotage, like externalized?
Yeah. That's what it is.
Okay.
Yeah.
And then that question, putting back into his body?
Right, that's an act of finding his seat. So finding it physically, right, finding the place where we sit. If we were talking about Soto Zen, that would be the whole thing. That would be the beginning, the middle, and the end. If once you find your seat, right, that's actualizing, you know, Buddha nature. As Buddha was encountering that moment, right, you could say critical self-doubt, then it's necessary to break through that. You know, like Buddha himself, everyone will experience that at some point, right? And there's no kind of cognitive answer that's really going to do it. It's the act of coming home and trusting our own experience 100%, our own eyes, ears, nose, tongue, body, mind. So then Buddha did that, and as he sat, he saw the morning star, and he trusted that, you know, just a star in the sky, maybe some bird song, the morning breeze, and it was enough. And he said, wonderful, wonderful. Each thing has it, each thing is complete. So there's a kind of radical inclusiveness in that. It means everything is part of our ecosystem. As we fully come home to ourselves and to our experience, then that seeing and connection is not a separate action or an intended action, it's just a natural action. So as sometimes we talk in Buddhism overall about wisdom and compassion, but they're like two wings of a bird. You know, as you develop insight, you see that connection, and then compassion is arising naturally. On the other hand, as you find yourself in compassionate activity, you know, through the natural acts of service that are our life, some insight emerges. And so whether you work on one side or the other, sometimes in our Zen tradition or in Tibetan tradition, certainly they'll emphasize wisdom, they'll emphasize the understanding. But what's really great is when His Holiness the Dalai Lama came recently to Boston, he looks around and he's like, oh, you guys, it's... He didn't emphasize the wisdom at all, but he really just talked about how necessary it is to have a good heart. And what happens really within all of these traditions is the mind comes within the heart. So the mantra that Mahagosananda used, the mantra that His Holiness the Dalai Lama used, Om Mani Padme Hum, may the jewel be within the lotus, may the mind be within the heart. And so, you know, working from that place of finding our center. In the even indigenous traditions, they say there's six directions, north, south, east, west, above, below. The seventh direction is the center. So finding our center and coming home. Yeah.
You asked Jim to tell his story about that. Jim, would you tell your story about with your teacher and talking about you use your mind? I love that story.
Yeah.
When I was in Korea, it was actually something introduced me to one of his teachers.
That's right.
And so I sat down, and this teacher did not speak very much English, and I did not speak very much Korean. But that was okay, and we had some tea, and he was trying to... he kept saying, in kind of broken English, but he was saying, you must understand your mind. You must understand your mind, right?
And I'm saying, okay. And he goes, no, you must understand your mind. I said, okay. And he goes, no, you must understand your mind. I said, my mind? And he slapped my hand away and he goes, no, you're mine. And that was a big moment for me. That was a big moment for me. It really stayed with me, and that was a moment of very important teaching for me. That message, it finally got through. Once me even mentioned it, of course, but the situation, the energy came together, and I got it.
Love that story.
That is a good story. Right, so on that note, I think we're finished. Thank you so much.
So we have a donation bowl on the counter, and we encourage you to contribute dana, the Buddhist word for sharing, essentially. And so if you share funds in that bowl, half of them will go to support our speaker's work, half of them we will retain to help maintain this space for further such events. I want to point out this lovely book. One of the things that is particularly nice about it is that there are a number of different exercises, simple exercises, mm-hmm. much like the one that we did tonight, interspersed throughout the book, as well as the sort of stories that we also heard. So please check that out, and I'm sure that our speaker will be happy to sign or autograph any that you wish. And finally, we look forward to seeing you at further events here and at the Tibetan Gallery in the future. Thank you so much.
Thank you. And I do consultations, astrology,
yes.
And spiritual counseling and energy work. And my website, I have some cards here.
Awesome.
Did you say astrology?
I do astrology.
What kind?
Western astrology.
Western astrology?
Yeah.
You've got some interest right here.
Yeah.